You are listening to the Horse Radio Network, part of the Equine Network family.
You're listening to the Show Jumping Podcast, a fun and informative show for riders, owners, trainers, grooms, and fans of all levels.
I'm Ashley Winch in Kansas City, Missouri.
And I'm Christy McCormick in Saratoga Springs, New York. And you're listening to the Show Jumping Podcast, where we answer your riding questions and chat with fellow horse enthusiasts about the world of show jumping. Coming up on today's show, we have a friend from across the pond joining us in Warwick, England, to talk about buying and selling horses there compared to buying and selling in the U.S. My good friend, Carolyn Curcio, who I've known since she was a junior rider, grew up riding and showing in New Jersey and made the move to England in 2018 to start a sales business. Hi, Carolyn.
Hi, Christy. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. Why don't you start by just saying, talking a little bit about how you got started in England and what made you make the decision to move there in the first place?
Super. So back in probably the winter of 2010, rolling back to when I was still a junior, I ended up catch riding a horse for Laura Kraut, an equitation horse that ended up getting sold after winning a few classes. And then fast forward to the summer of 2011, and I was incredibly lucky to go actually as a working student to work for her and Nick Skelton. And they actually base their town would be considered Henley and Arden, but it's only 15 minutes from where I base now. And then after that initial summer, Laura actually offered me the job of being competition rider for them. And I did that for a few years, and I really fell in love with the sport side that I was exposed to, the overlap in different disciplines, and really the grassroots side of horses that was incredibly accessible in England. And so, you know, go forward another 10 years. I came back to England when I worked for Lauren Huff and knew that this was the side of the pond that I wanted to be on. And I set down some roots. That's how I ended up here.
Talk a little bit about what you mean by the love of the sport and the grassroots part of it, because I think I know what you mean, especially getting to have a year to live there in my early 20s. And, you know, I think that we've created such a horse business over here, and we're all doing this. If you're doing this as of any kind of job, you're trying to do this to make some money. But can you just talk a little bit about the differences in how England and Europe as a whole keep horses more of a sport than a business?
Absolutely. So I think it's exactly as you said, in America, it's quite business focused, whereas, I can really only speak to England. Of course, I haven't spent so much time on the mainland continent, but horses in general are far more embedded in the culture. And people's lives bump up next to each other in a different way than in America. So you have breeders right alongside farmers, right alongside pony clubbers, right alongside all of the other sport disciplines that we think of. And so I think from a spectator point of view, that was hugely more popular over here. And I think because horses in general were so much more accessible to people, little kids, young people, anyone interested could find an easy way to connect with the horses and to be a part of the sport. And I think because of how the country is set up, it's more feasible for people here to earn a living Participating in the different facets of the equine industry. And that, I think, actually makes it easier for this side of the pond to then focus on sport or give birth to more depth of sport, if does that make sense?
Yes. And I think, you know, what you said about the farmers, you know, that's I remember living in Belgium and just going to farms, not pretty fancy,
yes,
what we consider farms in the state, you know, but actual working agricultural farms, and they had horses there, and the horses, you know, they weren't used what they used to be used for, as far as, you know, plowing fields and things, but the riding horses were right alongside the cows, and
exactly,
and it's as if, you know, every kid has a horse or two in their backyard, not because they said, "Mommy, I want a pony," but because it's sort of part of their family's business. And
exactly,
I think that's a huge difference, to the point where it makes horses, you know, a little more, or just riding in general, maybe a little more normalized. Do you agree with that? I think here nobody understands what we do unless you're a part of that really unique element. And there it's just like, oh, yes, of course I ride horses.
I think, yeah, that's exactly it. It's the accessibility, I think. I think it's, I grew up in the suburbs of Long Island, and it's not, I had an interest in horses and had to go and seek them out. Whereas mm-hmm. Particularly in England, they're just everywhere. Mm-hmm. So I think it's something people have an interest in, because it's kind of the way we grow up with baseball, you know, or yeah, a community basketball court or something like that, you know, like right, the village right, riding school. I guess that's what I mean by it's embedded in the culture a lot more.
I was just going to say, it's just short of a school sport, and perhaps there are schools there that, like you just said, that participate in that. And so, and I think another element to this, which I'd love to talk about with you as far as selling, is the expense has got to be, yeah, the expense here is insane. Even yes, for a kid to take once a week riding lessons, you know, that's just, I think the sticker shock is something that any family will go through, no matter how much they can afford, as far as what per lessons run. And 100%. I think there is just way more, you know, just the cost of riding alone can allow for more people to participate.
The world is definitely changing at warp speed over the, at least from what I've seen, the last 10 years of coming here on and off. But I think I did love that, because originally the first time I heard someone could keep a horse, have a horse to ride for £20 a week, mm-hmm, you know, like it's just a different world in America. And that, like you were saying, that plays into every other aspect of how we make our business plans, how we're able to function in business with the horses, and the logistics of it all. You know, like my hay comes from a field 5 minutes away, whereas yeah, you know, most of the horses in Florida are eating hay that's been shipped in from Washington State or New York State, or, you know,
yes,
thousands of miles away.
And all those miles of, you know, shipping in adds into, you know, become dollars. And then you end up paying, suddenly you're paying $50 for a bale of hay, and you're wondering, you know, why your bills are so high.
Exactly. It just closes people off to the sport and to
yes,
the animal.
Yes, exactly. And that's one of the things I struggle with here now, especially, you know, I've come away from working at this at such a high level with people who can afford to do this in a very particular way. And yeah, I'm starting to really realize how much that can change, not just the sport, but for sure the business. You know, buying and selling horses here is extremely difficult if you're not within a couple of certain circles. Not to say that anybody can't go out looking for horses, but the nicest horses in the country, their market has gone up incrementally because there's wealthy families that are buying them for more and more money.
Exactly.
And it just excludes so many people from even trying to participate and compete with them. How have you found that market? You know, how does that work for you there as far as selling horses? And what is your market as far as who's your average buyer that comes through your barn to buy horses?
So to be completely honest, the vast majority of the clients are still Americans.
Are they? Okay.
So for a long time, I had a joke about that I was based in England and I'd never sold a horse to someone who was going
to an Englishman in England. Yeah.
And I have clients in Europe and things like that. So it's, again, over here, it is changing again. I think there's a real battle and a real need for people to fight to keep Pony Club, to keep the Village Riding School and things like that. So it doesn't, there's always been a level of elitism in it, but I think it's definitely coming up in conversation at the highest levels of sport that it's we're cutting everyone out at this point. And so just riders and horse people alike kind of coming together to protect the fundamentals of what makes it all possible. And really, at the end of the day, that all starts with young people liking horses, you know.
Do you find you are approached by trainers or agents looking for horses for their buyers, and you know they're looking for a cut as well as far as adding on to the price? You think that is driving things up?
I think so. The majority of my clients would be professionals or would be professional agents. Mm-hmm. It's not so often that a direct client comes, say, themselves as an amateur.
Without somebody, yeah. And that's super, you know, totally valid. Most people need someone to help them, especially, you know, coming from here, navigating the European scene or the English scene, just to even find where to go, you know. And obviously anybody doing that needs to be paid appropriately. It just seems, and this happens in the States all the time, it just seems that, you know, sales, while they should be very transparent, are becoming less so. And I think that's really driving the sales, the prices of horses up as well, which is, you know, going back to our point, just keeping it more and more elite.
Yeah, and I think a few things are happening at the same time. So on the one hand, I actually actively avoid selling to people that don't have professional guidance, because I think there's a real horse welfare issue that's getting worse and worse, frankly. And then I think the general, your fixed costs of buying a horse are kind of skyrocketing. And then alongside that, you have, you know, like the commission side of things is always a little bit touchy, because it's a horse is worth what the market will bear. And when does a client become unhappy? A client becomes unhappy when said horse is bought to meet a specific purpose. And if that horse doesn't meet that specific purpose, depending on the amount of money spent, it, I guess, depends on whether or not they are happy. And I think it's, I really try to focus my skill set and my energy on making the most appropriate matches of horse to rider. And so I think, in a way, for sure, there's been an issue with people being too greedy and people wanting to be paid for not enough effort. But equally, I think you could tie the issue of commission a little bit to maybe an issue of competence, or because for me, like as an example, say you have a horse that jumps 110, and typically someone might say that that horse is worth, I don't know, throwing out a number, $25,000 or something. Yeah.
So we're talking like meter 10 children's adult jumper types.
Exactly. And, but someone comes up, but it's the best 110 horse in the world. Sure. And someone comes along and says, well, I have a client that wants to spend $150,000 on a 110 horse that's going to win. I don't see an issue in that horse being sold for that amount of money if it is what I purport it to be, and it goes and it does that job. I think we've run into bigger issues where someone says, I want a 110 horse that's going to go win, and I have a client that's going to spend $150,000, and someone sells them something that can't jump a meter and is lame.
Right. So you're saying basically what a horse is worth is what somebody will pay for it if it can hold up to that value.
Or
that expectation, I guess. Yeah, the value is really what somebody will spend. And on the counter side, if it's for the same amount of money but is a lemon, we'll call it, right? Like it's got a hole in it somewhere. We all claim it can jump meter 10, but it really can't even get around, like you said, a meter. I think more and more people, though, struggle with, there should be just a number placed on this horse. Why do I spend more if I have a bigger, if I happen to have a bigger budget? And I think that's where it comes in with the trainer saying, I have $150 to spend, so show me the best horse for it. And then they know it's really only worth $25,000, but they price it and pocket the rest of it. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, I think there's a fine line there where you're advocating for your client and you're trying to make money. And you're also, you know, trying to make sure that if you do a good job at advocating for your client, you're getting the best bang for their buck.
Exactly. I think as time goes on, I think it's a harder and harder balance to strike. With making horses more expensive, I think also it's not just if it's one trainer, one seller that is placing a price on a horse. And like so the example you were giving, I think what's also making it worse is, say that three phone calls are made between three different people from buyer to seller, and kind of that empty value.
Sure. Aside, now we're just adding on for doing very little work. Yes.
Exactly. And you're adding 30% onto the price of a horse for people that, you know, aren't involved in the nitty gritty and don't bear any accountability either. So like, for me, I think you can justify commissions depending on the level of accountability you're taking and the level of effort you're putting into the deal.
Agree with that. Yes, I think that's valid. But let's go back to the horse that, you know, somebody has $150 to spend and it's really worth, and that's a big range. It's generally not that huge. Let's call it a $75,000 horse, right? And the people have $150,000 to spend. Someone could argue that, why can't that horse be sold to the person for $75,000, even if they do have $150 to spend? And I think that's a little bit of, because all that's done now, that's the person who can afford more than the person who only had $75 to spend. So now they're out buying and they've raised the value of that horse so that other horses that might not be as talented or as great at that, you know, are now their value has increased on paper. And I think that, you know, put another zero on the backside of those numbers. That's what's happened here in the States, where some of these particular division horses, you know, doing at least in the hunter division, and I'm sure in the jumper division as well, are overpriced just because someone can afford it. And I guess that's where I am coming back to, what happened to the farmers who bred that horse? And they didn't make that money. You know, it's the third trainer down the road that made this money. And now maybe those people have all put in time to improve it. I always try to do the best I could for the client. And like you said, initially, the match really has to be important too, or that's the priority as far as how well the horse and rider suit each other. It's just the economics of it can be mind blowing to the normal person, and how much it costs. Anyways, we're talking about prices of houses here. But the way in which we do business, I would think, or I would hope that where it come, you know, when you're in a country that has a little more grassroots attached to the sport, there's a little more appreciation for the true value of a horse.
I think there is. And I think, there's also probably, and I don't know, it would take some people that were actually invested in it, But, you know, like the reason I think it's been allowed to get so out of control is because there is no blue book.
Right. Right. There's no regulation whatsoever.
There's no regulation. And the thing is, like, you know, and like, I've sold nice young horses. There's a very significant element to the industry of selling on the dream, mm-hmm. Of what that next animal may be or what that particular rider may
be. Right. The potential, this horse, what this horse could be in a year or two or three. Yes. And exactly. Placing value on that potential. I've sold that dream too. And I've believed it because I've had experience with horses that, you know, At 5 years old, we all call them $100,000. And let's just use round numbers because, you know, it's yeah. quite a range. And then we can all say, well, you know, give this horse 3 years. And assuming he continues to progress in the way that he looks like he will now, you know, athletically, he could be worth, you know, $400,000 in 3 years. And I think the mistake that trainers run into are placing those expectations that immediately becomes an expectation when the client purchases, right? So then yeah. it's your job to hold that up. Well, good luck if that doesn't happen and your percentage rate of that actually happening is really low. Just because they're animals, you know, and nobody knows how they're really going to develop. Some horses look great for the first year and then just stop. Well, being able to accelerate.
Well, and I think it's also gone a little bit awry or because, you know, I think it's important that we like protect the idea of the dream. We protect of the idea of like the future return on investment, because mm-hmm. that's an incredibly important driver for the industry. But I think also what's got made it worse is that there are fewer and fewer quote unquote horse people involved in that process. So people that appreciate that it's not a linear process, is it? It's pieces mm-hmm. of a puzzle. And yes. so like that horse may get hurt. That horse mm-hmm. may underperform. That horse may go through a 6 month phase where it's just jumping badly or it's growing or it's doing all of these things. Yeah. And so I think there's too many pieces of it, I think, that have become mismatched, you know, because I would hate for people to, I don't know if it's like the right word, to like vilify the idea of pursuing the dream of like the, of, you know, buying something for a dollar and selling it for
two. Oh, yeah. And I think the dream does exist. I think overselling the dream is the problem. I think that. Yes. If we're all, and it's really honestly impossible to place a number on what you think a horse will be worth at some point in the future. You know, none of us know what the future holds anyways, and not just for that horse. You know, the market affects, because it's unregulated, the market mm-hmm. affects the purchase price anyways. So I agree. And I love the idea, you know, that my favorite part about the business that I had was, if I was lucky enough to have clients that could afford to buy young horses, and then appreciating the process that it took to bring them along mm-hmm. and improving them in some way, whether it was for a turnover and to resell, or whether it was just to say, now this horse is ready for the client who bought it, who is an amateur exactly. rider, and now they're prepared. You know, that process I think is super valid and has so, you know, so much to be said for. And I wish people would. I hope that that buyers can see that too. Whether that's whether they're going to Europe to buy a horse or whether they buy it, you know, from their own barn and from their trainer. But I think that that's a really important reason to kind of keep an open mind and see, you know, see the potential in a horse.
And I also think in America, like we're, you know, my family was not horsey at all. So when I had parents that wanted to be supportive, and it's kind of interesting being on both sides of the process, like being a kid who was a client to now being a professional and trying to make a living out of the industry. Mm-hmm. You're also involving people in such a highly variable investment that I think the way you like paint the picture of what horses really are and what the process of investing horses really is. I think that also has not done the process any favors, has not done the industry any favors. You know, putting guarantees on horses for clients, that's
when there are when there can't be any. Exactly. Tell us if you have any, do you have any funny stories about anyone coming to try a horse in your barn? It doesn't have to be, you know,
yeah, no.
I don't know, it could be anything.
I've had, you know, so part of what I would consider part of my business plan is when I go myself to try horses. And to be honest, there's some funny stories of either, hi, can you come try my horse? I think it's a super commercial 140 horse to go to America. And you get there and it is like absolutely scopeless.
Or, and then how do you say that to them? Do you get on and you just break their hearts, you know, softly?
It's really interesting. You have to read the person a little bit. And because some people get really angry. Some people are just really genuinely shocked because they believe one thing versus another. And so I'm trying to learn. It's a bit by trial and error of what the best way is to handle those situations. What I run into a lot actually is people who have been told, and I blame Facebook for this, that their horse could be an American Hunter. This horse all of a sudden is far more valuable because someone on Facebook told them that it's worth all this money and these people think that this is their out in regards to this horse, but they have no understanding of what an American Hunter is or needs to be. And so you sometimes arrive somewhere or receive a horse and it's there's some funny stories about what people would consider a hunter to be.
I ran into, if just because it moves well on the flat means it's a hunter, and you take away how it jumps, if it's quiet, if it's pretty, and you know, all of the sort of basic check marks that we like to have for the hunters. That's a tough one.
I've had it where someone said to me their horse was stopping with them around 90 centimeters. And they said, but she's really pretty. And someone said she looked like she could be a hunter. So that person wanted like quite a bit of money for. And I said to them, I said, so if I called you up and I said that there was this horse that was stopping at 90 centimeters, but it's pretty, would you spend that amount of money on it?
Right. That sounds like a dressage horse to me if it's stopping at the jumps. Carolyn, we are actually running out of time, but I have so many more questions for you. I think we should do a second follow-up pod if you're into it, because
I would
love to give some advice to the average horse person as to how they could go about, you know, buying a horse in England.
I would love to walk everyone through it. I'd love to do a second chat. That would be great. Thank you so much for having me.
Fantastic. Well, let's plan on that. So part two will be coming up, and it will be a little more of a how-to or maybe also a what not to do. How's that?
Yes, absolutely. That would be great as well.
Cool. All right. Okay. Well, thanks, Carolyn. We'll catch up with you soon.
While international horse shopping certainly gives me a stomach ache, your horse's digestive tract will be in great shape with the help of Reline GI. Are you looking for a natural, long-term solution for your horse's digestive health? Reline GI goes beyond just treating systems. This unique combination of gut-supporting hyaluronan and immune-boosting beta-glucan works in harmony with your horse's body to soothe and protect their digestive system. Unlike other options that can disrupt digestion and nutrient absorption, Reline GI maintains your horse's natural balance. Don't just rely on our claims. Reline GI is trusted by leading veterinarians and supported by scientific research, including a study by Dr. Nathan Slovis that demonstrated its effectiveness in reducing ulcers in active horses. Plus, it's Clean Sport certified, making it safe for use in competitions. Don't forget, for an additional 10% off, use code SJP at checkout. And for our first question and everybody's favorite question and answer portion of the show is from Sarah, hailing in New York. Sarah asks, how do you allow the horse to move up or lengthen their step without chasing?
So chasing is a non-technical but very widely understood term in riding, in that you never want to make the horse feel like you are literally chasing them from their backs. And we have to remember that these animals, you know, their fight or flight instincts are pretty high and pretty direct from their stimulus. So we as riders are not just in control of what they do underneath us, but how they feel. And I think the first thing a horse thinks when they have a rider who's on them, who is moving their body in such a way that, you know, they're not just driving them forward, but maybe opening and widening their arms and kicking them aggressively, that's going to create a fear instinct with them, and is usually going to create a very fast departure from whatever gait you had. So backing it down into a riding, you know, and riding around the course technique, when you want your horse to go forward, you are always striving to encourage them rather than force them. So a nice light feel of the reins and a nice light feel of the leg are two primary steps you must have while you're trying to think about this. And a light seat. It's very important when you're asking a horse to go forward to use your seat quietly, because if you overuse it and you're driving them, then you're just creating way too much power and that you're going to have to slow down from eventually. So in an ideal world, if you're coming out of a corner to a jump, which is generally the time when people think chase, like they're trying to get to a distance or get to a jump, you would like to just think about increasing your stride little by little. I like to set up an exercise where at the top end of the turn, you start gradually adding on an increase of 10% of you're asking for an increase of 10% in the stride length each stride for about 6 to 8 strides. And that should mean you're adding about 10% per stride of pressure from your leg on them. And that way you're not being so aggressive so quickly that they're necessarily in fear and want to shoot forward, but they're taking the instruction from your leg to go forward. So let's say you are coming around a turn to a line of jumps or poles on the ground, and poles are a great way to do any exercise that has anything to do with pace, because you're not going to have any sense of injury if you make a mistake. So let's say you have a line of two poles on the ground that's set at a bit of a forward 5, and you practice it at a bit of a slow pace at 6 strides. And then the next time, think about that increase of 10% from the top end of the ring for about 6 strides coming out of the corner, and see where that gets you, and see if that gets you to the same pace that the 5 strides will need to be. Using poles for striding is a great way to measure if you're on the right pace or not. And as far as body position and feel goes, like I said, light to medium pressure on your legs, and you're with your heels down, so you have your support going down and not on your heel and not in your seat. A little bit of a light seat, maybe a 3-point or a 2-point position, and then a little feel of the reins, so that if they do have an overreaction from your leg, you can control how quickly they do move forward. So having your horse move up or lengthen their stride can really take a lot of practice and a little finesse with getting them to go forward without chasing.
And before we get to our last question, let's hear a quick word from our Equine Network sponsor, Spalding Labs. Easy, effective, and eco-friendly fly control starts with Fly Predators. Fly Predators are the organic, natural way to dramatically minimize your fly problem, saving you and your horse from battling them all season long. Take it from our 23,000 plus 5-star reviews. Fly Predators are the natural fly control that works. Learn more about Fly Predators and other Spalding Labs fly control solutions at spalding-labs.com. And finally, to wrap up our show, we have our last question coming to us from Catherine in Ohio. Catherine writes, how do you set achievable horse show goals? And how do you talk to your trainer, parents, financial provider about it? And what are some controllable factors to ensure success?
It's a loaded question, Catherine. Well, let's start with keep things reasonable and realistic. Many times people like to set goals that are just very, very far from what the reality of where their, you know, their current situation is. First, start by analyzing where you are. Where are you comfortable in your riding? Where is your horse comfortable in their training? That can be a variety of things. That can be what level of class you're doing at the horse show. That can be what height you're jumping. That can be just, is your horse doing lead changes properly right now? As far as horse show goals go, always looking towards something to qualify for is wonderful, but remember that the ribbons cannot be the goal. I've had too many students who say, I want to win a ribbon at this final or this event. And there are so many elements that are not within your control to ensure that ribbon, that if that is the definition of your success for that year, you're just set up to fail. So it doesn't necessarily mean shoot lower. It just means broaden your spectrum and look a little wider as to how you'd like to feel by the end of the year. Yes, qualifying for something is fantastic. And that's usually a goal that requires a lot of competing and gathering some points and not necessarily winning every class or winning a specific class, but sort of just working on consistency through the year. That's great. Talking with your trainer about if the goal you have in mind matches their goal for you. That's a really, really big important thing, because your trainer is supposed to be the person that gives you an honest opinion about where you are and where they think you're going. And if they're thinking 3 steps ahead, and you're thinking 10 steps ahead, you two need to figure out where to maybe not meet in the middle, but meet a little closer to what your trainer, you know, thinks of where you're going. I think working on what you can teach yourself and what you can learn from your horse is really valuable in terms of horse show goals, because you might start the horse show year getting around a course and not getting the number of strides correct in each line, or not having the right pace to get the strides for each line. And a simple goal could be, by midsummer, I want to be very comfortable with the forward pace I know my horse needs to get down the lines easily. And that's a huge goal in itself. If you're working towards calendar or certain events, just make sure that not only are they spaced out enough that you don't overwhelm yourself or your horse, but they include levels of progress, because it's not going to be a linear process. It's going to have some ups and downs, and you want to have a little breathing room space. So having these conversations with your trainer is really important. As far as finances go, that's another factor that really has to factor in. It's very easy to say, I want to qualify for X competition, but if you look at what qualified everyone in last year, and you realize that's going to require 10 horse shows that you have to do, but your budget allows for 7, then you need to adjust your expectations. You know, maybe that's not realistic, and that's okay. Find a different goal where you can say, okay, over those 7 horse shows, I'd really love for 5 of them to feel like we're improving in some way. Every horse show should be improving in some way, but not everyone's going to go the way, you know, the positive way you'd like. So keep things in a bit of a wide spectrum as far as what success means to you, and talk to whoever you're working with to make sure that you're within range of what you can meet.
That's some fantastic advice, Christy, especially on the you know, financial part of it. I know that's the piece that most people struggle with, because if it was free, we'd all have a million horses and be at every horse show.
Wouldn't we? Exactly.
So that's some great advice on everything. And if you have a question that you'd like Christy's expertise on or my terrible jokes on, be sure to write that. To write that in directly to me, Ashley@horseradionetwork.com, or stop by our Facebook group Overheard on the Show Jumping Podcast.
Ashley, I love your jokes. They're not terrible.